This is the 2011 West Coast School of the Prophets. The theme for the weekend is The Day of Yahweh Draweth Nigh. We have our brother Carl Perry from the Salisbury Ecclesia in Adelaide, Australia. This is our fourth session, and it's dealing with Moses. It's entitled, By Faith Moses Left Egypt. And our reading was Exodus chapter 2. Brother Carl.
Okay, thank you for that, Brother Jimmy. We're now going to change track completely and look at the life of Moses. In our introductory study, we looked at why the life of Moses was significant. He is an amazing example of leadership, of life. He himself becomes a type of Jesus Christ, a tremendous example to follow. Now, we're going to just set the scene a little bit. We spoke about Egypt in our introductory session. Egypt was a place of darkness, disease, death, oppression, and bitter labor. And it becomes a symbol of sin and death. It becomes a symbol of the environment that we live in. It becomes a symbol of everything that is against God. So how is God going to not only deliver Israel from this evil bondage, but raise up individuals against the tide of Israel's behavior in Egypt? Now, if you come to Ezekiel chapter 20, this paints the picture of what Israel was like at the time of the Exodus. Ezekiel chapter 20. In verse 6, in the day that I lifted up mine hand unto them to bring them forth of the land of Egypt into a land that I have espied for them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands, then said I unto them, cast ye away every man the abomination of his eyes, and defile not yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. But they rebelled against me and would not hearken unto me. They did not every man cast away the abomination of their eyes, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. Now that is telling us a piece of information that we don't learn in Exodus. It's telling us that by the time Moses came to deliver this people, the people were full of idols and refused to get rid of them. So the question is, how does God not only deliver these people from idolatry and change them and deliver them, but how does he actually raise up individuals in the darkness of Egypt to be godly people? Now we find that interesting because we live in a dark and degenerate age. What is the secret of bringing up young people, young brethren, young sisters, young families in an age of darkness? How did God do that? We want to explore that this evening and see what an amazing man God raised up in Moses. There's a certain irony about the Exodus and the bondage. An awful irony. You see, in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 11, or should I say verse 10, this is the reasoning of Egypt. Come on, let us deal wisely with them. This is the serpent speaking. This is the Pharaoh with the serpent on the head, as we saw in our introductory study. This is the carnal mind. Let's deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Now, they would not have reached that conclusion if they were not aware of some type of national movement to go back to the promised land. I mean, they just didn't pluck that out of the air and say, this is a good reason to keep them in Egypt. There was clearly some discussion, public discussion, about getting out of Egypt and going back to the promised land. How do they know that? Well, we know the promise made to Abraham, in the fourth generation they shall come out thither. And by the time this is happening, we'd come to the fourth generation. But of course, they were taken upon themselves to come out of Egypt. God had a different plan altogether. But it's quite clear that they had some idea that they want to go back to Egypt. The Egyptians got wind of that and said, we'll suppress them. Yeah. Yep. Exodus 1 verse 11. 10 and 11. Yep. There's movement afoot and Egypt crushes it. So verse 11, therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now the Hebrew word treasure cities is store cities. They weren't actually used for gold and silver. They were store cities used for food. Now, here is the evil of Egypt. They had just been delivered a few generations before by Joseph. And Joseph's idea was that in the good years, you put aside a certain percentage to store up for the bad years. And he ruled Egypt wisely, and Egypt got through that. Now there arose a new king who knew not Joseph. And there's now a twist in the story. Ah, what a great idea to store corn for future years. And I'll tell you what, let's use the very people who suggested the idea as our slaves. How is that for warped thinking? Pithom means city of justice. There was no justice in that decision. Ramses means child of the sun, but this nation was the child of God. So there's an irony in this arrangement. I mean, how evil is it for a people to reject the memory of Joseph? And as a reward for all of that wonderful service, forgetting all about Joseph, they now say, yeah, let's get store cities, but we'll make the very people of Israel build them as slaves. That's Egypt. That is Egypt. But there's a little light in this dark story in chapter 1. In verse 15, we read that the king of Egypt, now remember last session we dealt with that Pharaoh is often called the king of Egypt, because he stands as a symbol of king sin. Well, here's a classic example of that. In verse 15, he's not called Pharaoh. He's called the king of Egypt. This is king sin at his worst. He spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah. Now, whenever you read in the Bible, the name of so-and-so, the name of so-and-so, the record is inviting you to grab your concordance and check the meaning of the name. Whenever you come across that, the name of the one, the name of the other, it's inviting you to check the meaning of the name. Shiphrah, she means brightness, and Puah means glittering or brilliant. So in the darkness of Egypt are these two sisters, brightness and glittering and brilliant. Now you imagine, here's the court of Pharaoh. Pharaoh is the supreme ruler of the country. And he's asking these two sisters to come into the Egyptian court and get an instruction from him. You imagine how terrified these two sisters were. He said to them in verse 16, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, that's the birthing stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. If it be a daughter, then she shall live. Imagine getting an instruction. Now clearly these two sisters were the heads of the midwives. They didn't do all the baby deliveries in Egypt, but they were in charge of that. Brought into the throne room, all the regalia of Egyptian evil, the power and dominance of this empire, the impressive presence of Pharaoh, the intimidating presence of Pharaoh. Whenever you see a boy, kill him. Let the girls live, but the boys kill. Now, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You imagine the faith you're going to need to resist that commandment. What would you do? Well, in verse 17, the midwives feared God. What an amazing testimony to their faith. Feared God. Now that expression, feared God, is an Abrahamic expression. Come to Genesis 22. And it appears in the context where God said to Abraham, offer up thy son, thine only son. In verse 12 of Genesis 22, The angel said, lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him, for now I knowest that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. So the faith and the obedience that Abraham experienced in Genesis chapter 22 is precisely the same kind of faith for these two sisters in the darkness of Egypt. How about that? Not all is dark in Egypt. There's just a few lights burning bright, these two sisters. They feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded. Well, it's one thing to defy the decree of Pharaoh. Great though that was, wonderful though that was. In verse 18, they're summoned into his presence. The king of Egypt called for the midwives. Why have you done this thing and saved the men children alive? Now you imagine being brought in a second time. You have deliberately disobeyed this command. You have deliberately allowed the men child. What do you say for yourselves? Why have you done this? Now, two sisters alone in the court of Pharaoh, how would you think you'd answer that? And they had the presence of mind to say in verse 19, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. What a statement. It's like saying Christadelphian young people are not like worldly young people. The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. That is a magnificent testimony to the fact that these people stayed different to the Egyptians. So you know, when we go to work, when we're at college, and people see us, do they see a distinction? Or are we just like the Egyptians? Is there a facet of our character and our behavior and our speech and our approach towards life that sets us apart from the Egyptians? Because the two sisters here said the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They're different. And what's the difference? Verse 19, they are lively. They're alive. The Egyptians are dead, but they are alive. God worked with the birth process to allow the children to be quickly delivered, quickly taken off the spot before the Egyptians arrived. God worked with their faith. But in verse 22, we have the first genocide in the scriptures. Before we get to that verse, God preserved these midwives from Pharaoh's threats and anger, because in verse 20, therefore God dealt well with the midwives and the people multiplied. You know, one would have expected them to be executed. But in the promise of God, God preserved those two women. An amazing testimony of faith. Standing up against King Sin, we're not like the Egyptians, we are alive. That's the testimony of those two sisters. Astounding. But in verse 22, genocide. He commanded his people to destroy the men child. Now, this sets the scene for the birth of Moses. God chooses the most extreme genocide to produce this incredible family, to demonstrate that you can develop godliness in the worst possible ungodly environments. Now let's look at how this happened. Verse 1 of chapter 2. There was a man of the house of Levi and took a wife, a daughter of Levi. What's the first thing you notice about that verse? What's the verse telling us about this marriage? Sorry? Yeah, it's two people from Levi, but let's go a bit deeper. What's it telling us? A godly family? In the same tribe, in the same truth. So there's a compatibility about the marriage. The same tribe, the same instincts, the same direction, the same interests. You know, young brethren, young men, for those of you who are not married, when you get a partner and you choose a partner and you go out with a partner, it's not just a matter of man and woman being in the truth. It's a matter of the compatibility going beyond that. That's, of course, an essential part of it. But it's similar values, similar attitudes, similar approaches, similar standards, similar view to the Word of God. That's what makes the compatibility. There have been a number of marriages where people have married in the truth and think that that's okay. I married a sister, I married a brother in the Lord. That is not enough. And some of those marriages have disintegrated, tragically disintegrated, because the values have been different. The approaches have been different. Find somebody who's compatible. Not only in the truth, but compatible to your ideals. So that's the first point. How do you produce a godly seed? In the middle of darkness and evil, compatibility in the truth. Same tribe. A godly tribe. Same values. The second point is this. Amram actually married an older woman. I'm not saying that you should marry older women, but what I'm saying is that there's forethought in this. Come to Exodus chapter 6, verse 20. Amram, verse 20 of chapter 6, took him Jochebed, his father's sister, to wife. So here's the compatibility. It's part of the same family. Now, his father's sister, we're not going to go through the genealogies, but we find in the genealogies, in fact, that his father's sister, Jochebed, was an older woman, a maturer woman. So what the record is saying is that it was a very carefully thought out marriage. He sought a mature woman from the same family. It's not just love at first sight and that's it. There's a bit of forethought here. The kind of woman that interests him is the kind of woman who's mature and is also part of the same family, the same attitudes. See that? Now, the other point, too, is when we come to Exodus chapter 15, before we actually get there, Amram and Jochebed. Amram means exalted people. Jochebed means Yah is glory. Okay, Amram means exalted people. Jochebed means Yah is glory. And Moses, in fact, had to learn in the end that it was God's glory, not his own, that was important. Now, come to Exodus 15. This tells us about the education within the family. Exodus 15. This is when they sang that remarkable song of victory at the Red Sea. Verse 1 of Exodus 15. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto Yahweh and spake, saying, I will sing unto Yahweh, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him. Now you imagine if you just had a victory song, and you were singing this song to God, and you had the opportunity of bringing your dad and his God into the song. What a tremendous honor that would be to the family. My father's God. So it is quite clear that from a very early age, Amram and Jochebed were impressing upon the three children. Who were the three children, by the way? Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Three leaders in Israel, not just brethren and sisters, but leaders in Israel. It is obvious that my father's God was so preeminent in the family that when he came to sing this victory song, he had to mention the fact of his father's God. So the tuition of the children wasn't just Sunday school lessons by rote. It was the essence of God in that lesson. God in those lives, God in that family, my father's God. Now the third point is Acts chapter 7. We'll be coming backwards and forwards to Acts 7 and Hebrews 11, but I just want you to note Acts 7. This is the other powerful educational tool that Amram and Jochebed used for their kids. Acts 7. Verse 23 tells us this. When he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. So here's a young boy who has been removed from the family, ends up in the court of Egypt, educated in Egypt, but there is still in his heart an affection for his people that no education in Egypt could wipe out. What does that mean? It means that Amram and Jochebed had this capacity when they're teaching their kids the truth to get to the heart. That's not altogether easy, parents. Some of you young brethren here are parents. To get to the heart. It's not just learning things by rote and cramming them with knowledge. Knowledge is important, I'm not saying it isn't, but the heart has got to be touched. My Father's God, the heart. So it doesn't matter what the education of the world throws at these kids, in the end it will come back to their heart. Yep.
Well, since Moses was a baby, was he not, or after he weaned, how much could the father have taught him unless they still had some type of contact or relationship?
Excellent. Let's come back to Exodus chapter 2. We're setting the scene for three remarkable children from a remarkable family in the darkness of Egypt. You can do it. It can be done. Verse 2 of Exodus chapter 2. The woman conceived and bare a son. Now just think about this. Imagine if you were in Egypt and the decree had gone from Pharaoh, any boy that's born, off with their head, or they'd be drowned actually. Would you, as a responsible parent, think about bringing a child into the world, knowing that if it was a boy, you'd lose them? And yet this verse, where the woman conceived and bare a son, is in the context of knowing about the decree from Pharaoh. That's faith. Now this language here, the woman conceived, what does that remind you of? Genesis. It didn't say Jochebed conceived, the woman conceived and bare a son. That's the language of the seed of the woman. That's also the language used of Jesus Christ. A woman shall conceive and bear a son, shall call his name Jesus. So there's language here being embedded in the record that has some significant reference later on. Now verse 2 says, he was a goodly child. Now, all mums think their babies are goodly children, even if they have a face only a mother can love. They are all goodly children. So what's the record saying? What's the point of this? Come to Acts 7. Stephen provides a little bit of extra information, Acts chapter 7. Verse 20, in the which time, that confirms the point we just made, that they fully knew of the decree of Pharaoh to kill all the baby boys. In the which time Moses was born. That's faith. And was exceeding fair. Now you see the margin, if you have a marginal reference. Fair to God. So there was something about the birth of this child, and he was not the firstborn of that family. He was the thirdborn of the family. That was fair to God. What made that child precious to God? As distinct from the other two children, born specifically in defiance of the decree of Pharaoh. What made him precious to that boy? To God. There is only one answer to that, and that is that at some point, Amram and Jochebed knew that this boy had a destiny to play in Israel. It's the only way you can come to that conclusion. That they understood his role in delivering the nation. He was fair to God. It's the only conclusion you can come to. They both believed on this and they both acted upon it. Fair to God. Let's come back to Exodus chapter 2. The question was asked, if the child was given to Pharaoh's daughter very early on, how on earth did this education continue? Well, we have the answer in verse 9 of Exodus chapter 2. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. It does not say at what point the child was brought to Pharaoh. It must therefore have been old enough to have some Hebrew education first. It's the only way that works. I mean, clearly, if the boy had just been 3 or 4 months old and given to Pharaoh's daughter, there'd be no opportunity to educate him in Hebrew ways. But there was enough window for Amram and Jochebed to touch that boy's heart and to make sure that his father's God was part of the education. And that small, short window, 6, 7, 8 years, we don't know, but they were sufficient to guide him through Egypt's education. That's astounding. Imagine parents, if you've just had a window of 6 or 7 years to teach your children the heart of the issue of the truth, which would resist any kind of influence. Could you do it? Could you touch your children's heart to that extent? Well, Amram and Jochebed did, an astounding couple. It is possible to produce godly children in an ungodly environment. Touch the heart with the word of God. Verse 10, he became her son. Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, verse 22, he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, mighty in words and deeds. Now I want you to think about that. It was a royal education, so it's the best teachers at the best universities. Learning to read and write hieroglyphics, we have trouble running English. That's why we have spell check on our documents. These are hieroglyphics. You've seen how difficult hieroglyphics are. He studied maths, geometry, surveying, trigonometry, architecture, painting, medicine, all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Music, religion, philosophy. Josephus, in fact, goes a little bit further and says that he was a military commander. The record doesn't know anything about that, except that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Now, I've been to Egypt, and I've seen the superstition of the Egyptian priesthood in the Book of the Dead. And I've had the guide explain to me all the ridiculous things. The idols of Egypt, scarabs, crocodiles, monkeys, snakes, all of that ridiculous idolatry, all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And it didn't make an ounce of difference. It's like an educational thing to pass an exam. I've got to learn evolution. I've got to learn about hieroglyphics. I've got to learn about the religion of Egypt. He was capable. He was intelligent. He excelled in everything that he did. He could command the future. But there was something that had touched his heart before called the truth. So, young brethren, if you're doing university, doing college, whatever it is, just view the education as that, an education. Don't be affected by that. Learn what you have to learn, but do not neglect the things of God. If you want a classic example of going to college for 3 years and excelling in the truth, read Daniel chapter 1. He was put into a program, a 3-year university program, in which it was not just to educate him in Babylonish ways, it was to make him Babylonian. And he became more wise than all of those people because he did more Bible study than he did educational study in Babylon. Fascinating story. 3-year degree in Babylon, he came out wiser and stronger in the truth than when he went in. Don't let your education warp your sense of priorities. If you've got to do the education to get a job, do it. But make it just a tick in the box, get a job. Do not become affected by it. And don't use it as an excuse to neglect your Bible study. Be like Daniel, be like Moses. There was something else more important than all of this. See, they're good lessons, aren't they, when you think about it? Now, verse 11 of Exodus 2 says, "And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren." Now, this verse only contains part of the story. It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown. We read in Acts 7, verse 23, when he was full 40 years old. So he's been through university, he's been through education, he's now a grown man, he's probably an administrator in the affairs of Egypt. All their wisdom and culture, mighty in works and deeds. He's dynamic, he's popular, he's progressive, he's intelligent, he is everything that Egypt wants. And all of a sudden, the 40-year mark comes. In Hebrews 11, we need to fill in the rest of the story. Let's look at this in Hebrews 11. Something significant happened at 40, and it wasn't necessarily a midlife crisis. Hebrews 11 and verse 23 introduces the parents again. "By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents," plural. How do you develop godly children? Mum and dad are on the same page. Mum and dad have the same values. Mum and dad have the same critical faith. "By faith of his parents. Because they saw he was a proper child." And as I explained before, it's not just because they thought he was a good-looking kid. It's because he was fair to God. God had clearly outlined that this boy was part of his purpose. When they saw he was a proper child, they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Like the two midwives, they did not fear the king. That's the parents. Now, verse 24. "By faith, Moses, when he was come to years." So this is Exodus 2, verse 11, isn't it? This is Acts 7:23. He's 40 years old. "He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter." Now hold on a minute. Exodus 2 said he was Pharaoh's daughter. So what's verse 24 saying? He refused to be called Pharaoh's daughter. Well, refuse implies a choice. And that word "called" in the passive can mean to be appointed. He refused to be appointed the son of Pharaoh's daughter. What that is an official court title. He's always been Pharaoh's son. But now there is a specific appointment when he reaches the age of 40. Now you imagine that. Moses comes into the court. Here's Moses, Moses the Great, mighty in all the works and deeds of the Egyptians, the rising star of Egypt, the world before him, can command what he wants. He's now invited into the presence of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh now offers him the official title, son of Pharaoh's daughter. And Moses turns around and says, "No, thank you." Can you imagine the reaction from the court? "You ungrateful son, all that we've given and done for you, you refuse this title." You imagine the rage from the court. And the decision is in verse 25, choosing, so it's a choice again. A choice, a deliberate choice. "Rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Now, if someone offered you $20 million, strings attached, or to be beaten and suffer with this despised people, what decision would you make? $20 million with a few strings attached, or to suffer humility, beating, and ignominy with these Israelites? What would you choose? Ah, that's a bit far-fetched. Would you choose the promotion at work, which takes you away from your family, which means more money? Or would you choose a bit more Bible study to help the ecclesia? We're faced with choices like that, aren't we? Choices that involve personal advancement, but at the cost of something in relation to our family and the truth. And we're going to make a decision. And we stand exactly like Moses stood. But in Moses' case, the choices were enormous contrast. To be heir to the throne of the world, or to suffer with these people down here. He chose rather to suffer. You see, because the money and the status at the end of verse 25 involved the pleasures of sin for a season. Now that tells us an enormous amount of what's going through Moses' mind. Number one, whatever Egypt offers me, it'll only be for a season. And on the other side of the scales is eternal life. Season, eternal life. I understand that choice. Egypt, pleasure. But it's the pleasure of sin. On the other hand, is humility and righteousness and truth. I'll choose the humility, righteousness and truth. Verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ. Now hold on, Jesus Christ wasn't born then. But you see, the word Christ means Messiah. Messiah is the deliverer. He esteemed the reproach of being Messiah greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Now Hebrews 11 verse 6 says, without faith it's impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. He had respect unto the recompense of the reward. His faith believed not only that God existed, but that the reward that God offered far, far exceeded anything the world could give you. Do you believe that? Yep, the promotion, the money, status, the extra income, all good for a season, but it comes at a cost. We've got to weigh those costs up. If that puts a stumbling block in our life and takes us away from the truth, what have we achieved? But he esteemed, he made that decision, he weighed up the options. I want the reward that God gives me far more than I want the reward of Egypt. And I'm prepared to suffer the reproach of being Messiah. So you see, it was a conscious decision, esteeming the reward that God gave him more than anything else. He had respect under the recompense of the reward. So when we come back to Exodus chapter 2, that's what is happening in verse 11. The only way that he could honestly believe that he was the deliverer is if his parents told him. And the only way his parents could know is if they'd had some vision to prove the point. And that thought the parents had instilled in that boy to the extent that it had touched his heart, so that Egypt's education could not touch that. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Verse 11, it came to pass when Moses was grown that he went out unto his brethren. So he has rejected the official court title, son of Pharaoh's daughter. He's rejected Egypt. He's now gone down to his brethren. Now, these are idolaters. These are wicked people. But the generosity of Moses is that he viewed them as his brethren. That's a great spirit. That is a great spirit. His brethren, even though they were idolaters, they were still his brethren. He looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. There's that emphasis again. One of his brethren. Keep your hand here, come to Acts 7. Acts 7 gives us a bit more information. Stephen's speech. In verse 23, when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not. There was a great sense of justice in Moses' life. And this comes out later on when he judged the nation. And seeing one of his brethren suffering affliction, suffering wrong, he defended him. And that really is the hallmark of Moses' life. He is consistently judging and defending his people. So even right back here in Egypt, that quality was not lost. He avenged him that was oppressed. That was where you went wrong. He could not abide someone suffering wrong. But you don't defend the wrong by killing the opposition. The servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, says Paul in Timothy. And Moses, of course, who's mighty in word and in deed, intervened with great violence, stunned the enemy, killed him, hit him in the sand. He was a capable fighter. But God does not use the vengeance of man to deliver his people. Let's come back to Exodus chapter 2. He looked this way and that way, verse 12. And when he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He saw there was no man. Well, literally, of course, no one was looking, but figuratively, that expression, there was no man, is picked up in the book of Isaiah. I'm just going to give you the quotation. You can chase through the significant. Isaiah 59 and verse 16. Try and discover why Isaiah 59, 16 should use that expression in the context of how it's used in Exodus chapter 2. There was no man. But there was someone looking. And that was God. Now he'd murdered somebody. He had murdered somebody. So verse 13, he went the second day, and behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said to him that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? Now again, come to Acts chapter 7. We have some more information about this. Acts chapter 7. They struggle together. So here's two brethren struggling. It's a little bit different from a brother struggling with an Egyptian. It's two brethren. In Acts chapter 7, verse 26, the next day he showed himself unto them. What does that mean? It means that he made a deliberate appearance to proclaim something to them. What he actually was doing was he was declaring that he was now their deliverer. He showed himself to them. But you see, they were fighting as they strove. So what he did yesterday in killing the Egyptian, what he did in announcing his candidacy for the deliverer from Egypt, made not the slightest bit of difference to the brethren. They kept on fighting. And in verse 26, he would have set them at one again. He's a reconciler. He's a peacemaker. He saw himself as setting people together, to bring them unitedly together. Sirs, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one to another? He's intervening. Sorting out problems. This is the Moses that later on leads the nation. This is the quality of the man. To seek justice, to seek reparation, to seek unity and peace. But he's ignored. So back in Exodus chapter 2, one of the men said, in verse 14, who made thee a prince and judge over us? That is only relevant if he had made that declaration to them. And the question was a very good question, even though, of course, it was cynically said, who made thee? And that touched a raw nerve with Moses, because he probably suddenly realized that no one had made him that. God hadn't yet come to him to say, it's now time to be a ruler and prince and judge over us. So when that question came, who made thee? That would have struck a very raw nerve with Moses, because I think he would have realized he's doing it by himself. God had not endorsed the appointment. Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? That's a quote in the New Testament. Come to Luke chapter 12. In Luke chapter 12, verse 13, we have two brethren striving. Verse 13 of Luke 12. And one of the company said unto him, Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. Here are two brethren fighting over an inheritance. And one felt that he was wronged. He felt he required justice. He felt he required some sort of fairness. And the Lord's response in verse 14 is, man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? That's the words of Exodus chapter 2 and verse 14. Verse 15, beware of covetousness. Verse 21, be rich towards God. That was exactly the decision that Moses had made in Egypt. He had rejected the wealth of Egypt. He was rich towards God. He had forsaken covetousness. The Lord is alluding to all of that, but he's making the point that it's not my responsibility at the moment to be a judge and ruler over you. God has not yet appointed me in that position. Moses didn't understand that. Let's come back to Exodus chapter 2. At the end of verse 14, we read, and Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. The question is, what is this thing? Is it the slaying of the Egyptian? The this thing is what the two brethren were striving about. Who made thee a prince and judge over us? That information got back to Pharaoh. So here's Pharaoh. Not only has his golden-haired child rejected son of Pharaoh's daughter, thrown everything that Egypt had given them back in the face of Pharaoh, this man has now identified himself with the Hebrew slaves and proclaimed himself a prince and ruler over that people, in absolute defiance, in absolute contrast to Pharaoh. That's what made Pharaoh angry. This thing is the proclamation that Moses was now a prince and a deliverer. And he ran, he fled, says Exodus chapter 2. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. When you read Exodus, you think Moses is running to save his life. Come to Hebrews 11. That's not the situation at all. Hebrews 11. And you need the New Testament record, don't you, to fill in the gaps. Because Paul says this in Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 27. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. So when you read Exodus, you think Pharaoh's furious with this man. Moses flees, and you think, okay, well, he's running away from Pharaoh because Pharaoh's after him. Hebrews 11 says that's not the case. Now, the only way that you can by faith forsake Egypt is if you believe you're coming back. And that's precisely what went through his mind. I'm leaving, but I believe fully that God will use me at some future stage. I will be coming back. By faith he forsook Egypt. Not fearing the wrath of the king, because he knew that he would be saved in some way to deliver Israel later on. He didn't fear the king's wrath, because he knew that God would preserve him. Verse goes on to say, he endured as seeing him who is invisible. How can you see the invisible? Only by faith. The only way you can see the invisible is by faith. He endured. But let's come back to Exodus chapter 2. Now, we've got an option. We have a break, come back in 15 minutes, or we can continue on for the 4 hours. What would you like? No. Let's take a break for 10 minutes. Let's be back at, say, 5:02, and we'll then spend another half an hour or so to finish the story off. Okay? Let's do that. Thanks. I can see a few of you waning. Exodus chapter 2. All right, we left Moses fleeing, but in faith. Now, Exodus chapter 2 and verse 15. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now, that is intriguing. Here is a very rough map of the district. The Nile Delta, the Nile, Israel, Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee. Now Moses could have gone that way. He could have gone that way back to the land. But instead he drives down south. So you have to ask yourself the question, why that direction? And the point is that it's something like over 350 kilometers from Egypt into the land of Midian.
What's a
1 mile equals 1.6K. Do the maths. And yet the record says nothing about all of the miles in between or the kilometers in between. It just says at the end he sat down by a well. So you have to ask yourself the question, why did he go in that direction? And why is the record ignoring the fact that he would have stopped at a lot of places on the way, but he came to a well? The Hebrew is the well. That's why we have that word on the board, the well. It was obviously a prominent well. Now we're going to see enacted a little parable here. That well is going to represent something. Before we get to that, though, let's look at the land of Midian and the priest of Midian. Verse 16. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Now, why on earth are we interested in all the drama of Egypt, the vastness of the court of Egypt, everything that's happening about delivering Egypt, about this little disagreement at a desert well? Why are we interested in that? Because there's a deeper significance in the incident. The priest of Midian. The margin is incorrect. The Hebrew word does relate to a priest. What is a priest of Midian doing in Sinai? Who is Midian? And who is this man that's called a priest? Now in Genesis 25, let's come back to Genesis 25. This is what we learn about Midian. Where did he come from? Well, in Genesis 25 and verse 1, then again Abraham took a wife and her name was Keturah. And she bare him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shuah. So Midian is a son of Abraham. Midian is a son of Abraham. Now, Genesis 18, verse 19, we read this, where God says about Abraham, "For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do justice and judgment." So Midian, being one of the sons of Abraham, was taught the truth by Abraham. In Genesis 25, in fact, all those boys were sent away. What's interesting is this, is that Abraham sends his children into the east country, and up here, around the Golan Heights, is Midian. So point number one, he sent away, Midian establishes a family here, they start off knowing the truth. So what on earth is one of these descendants of Midian doing all the way down here? And how is it that in any direction that Moses could flee, he goes south and bumps into that family? There's only one answer to that. It's called the providence and foresight of God. That God should foresee a time when Moses would need a further development of his education. He'd had 40 years in Egypt. It was now time to change to a different kind of mentor and educator. This man will be the priest of Midian. And in the providence of God, God allows this family to separate miles and miles and miles from the normal district of Midian to end up in a desert as a priest. Now, as a priest, he retained the patriarchal function of the firstborn. Was this man an acceptable worshipper of God? Let's answer that. Exodus chapter 18. And verse 12. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Was he a righteous man? Yes. Did he have the truth? Yes. Was he a faithful priest? Yes. Isn't that astounding? That here's Israel, 400 years in Egypt. The idolatry of that country was matched the blackness of the nation of Egypt. And yet down here in the desert is a little family hanging on to the truth. How about this? Exodus chapter 3. Even the place where they worshipped, at the end of verse 3 was called the mountain of God. So not only did he have the truth, not only was he worshipping God correctly, not only did he sacrifice and offer to God acceptably, but even the very place was called the mountain of God. Astounding. And in the promise of God, God drives him down south. Was Moses aware of Midian? We don't know. The suggestion is in the record that he wasn't aware of who Jethro was. Because he came across the doors and didn't know them. Yes.
Well, just the question would be, is this was before the priesthood, so how did he get that title as priest, kind of like Melchizedek?
Exactly right. In the patriarchal system, the firstborn was in fact the priest of the family. The evidence of that is that Joseph, with the coat of many colours, that particular coat was a priestly garment, a kethaneth. And therefore the firstborn had that right of priesthood. And that's why Joseph was out of favour, because he wasn't the firstborn, but his father was giving him that responsibility. It could only come through Abraham, because Abraham offered sacrifice, which in turn came from Melchizedek. So yes, here is a priesthood predating the Levitical priesthood. Exactly. Good point. Thank you for introducing that. Now, this man's got a name. He's got two names, in fact. His name is Jethro. In chapter 3, verse 1, he's called Reuel. Jethro means remnant. Reuel means friend of God. He is a representative man. He is a faithful man, a priest. He is a symbol of the remnant of God. He is in fellowship with God as the friend of God. Chapter 3, verse 1, he's called Reuel. Verse 18 of chapter 2, he's called Jethro. He's the same man. Different name, one may have been a title. And the record says he had seven daughters. Seven is a symbol number of, number seven, the number of the covenant. So here's a little group stuck down in Egypt, associated with a remnant, associated with the covenant, drawing water from the well. What does the well represent in Scripture? Yes, the water of life. I'm thinking of a particular quote in Isaiah. Okay, could you turn to Isaiah 12 verse 2 and read it out for the group? Isaiah 12 verse 2. Verse 3.
Therefore with joy shall ye draw water out of the wells of salvation.
The well represents salvation. This water is providing water for the sheep that belong to the remnant. And the other shepherds come, not of this fold, and deliberately try and destroy that connection. And it's Moses that comes to deliver them. Now, when we come to Exodus chapter 2, the record uses a special little word. In verse 19, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds. And that word delivered means to save. So he couldn't save Israel. But he could save a small remnant associated with the covenant, providing the wells of salvation for the sheep. He could defend them from false shepherds. And that was his work. So it's intriguing that although he was rejected by his people, wasn't yet time to deliver them, he was accepted by the small remnant. Amazing, the promise of God. Think about the promise of God. to understand that at this particular point of time, Moses will be rejected and he'll run away. I've also got to bring a faithful family down from Midian all the way down to Mount Sinai, and I've got to make them meet. And the reason why we have to make them meet is because I have to give Moses the second part of his education, the education of priesthood. And Jethro taught Moses the power of being a mediator. He taught him compassion because he was a priest. He taught him the principles of sacrifice and offering. He taught about forgiveness and dedication and fellowship, the responsibility of shepherding. He could never get that education in Egypt. So this man is providentially put there in a most remarkable fashion. And the record says in verse 21 that Moses was content, the word means pleased, to dwell with the man. You know, he would have just been very thankful that God had put him in this environment. He was pleased because he saw the promise of God at work. He saw that this man would help him. And in verse 20, he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. Now, Zipporah is interesting. Verse 21, sorry, Zipporah. Her name is a little bird. Can anyone think of a New Testament reference about little birds? Yep. Can you read for us Matthew 6:26, please? You're the man of the quotes tonight. Matthew 6:26.
Behold, the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are ye not much better than they?
The little birds become a symbol of trusting in God. And her name, in this context of being part of seven daughters, by the well of salvation, part of the remnant, is another point showing the faithfulness of this family. Though she was a little bird, nevertheless, she put her trust in God. Now here's the unusual thing. She wasn't a Midianite. Tim, could you turn to Numbers 12 and verse 1 and read out Numbers 12 and verse 1? She's not a Midianite. Now the Hebrew word for Ethiopian is Cush. She's a Cushite. And in the Bible, there are two Cushites. Over here by the Euphrates, there was one Cush. And over here, opposite Sinai, was the other Cush. I think this is the Cush that he came in contact with. Now what does this mean? I mean, she's a Cushite woman. How did this man, Jethro, marry a Cushite to have a Cushite daughter? The only way that could happen is if there is interchange across the Gulf. And it's quite clear that women in those days didn't move across. So Jethro is actually moving across the Gulf here, and he finds a Cushite, and they have a Cushite daughter. Now what does that tell you about Jethro? Why would he cross the Gulf? Well, it could be by trade, it could also be by preaching. But whatever it was, he's got a foreign wife. So here is an ecclesia in the desert, a remnant associated with the covenants of promise, and there is a Gentile bride in that arrangement. Isn't that interesting? I mean, what an amazing parable is being established here. And he's called the friend of God. Moses was content, and this Ethiopian connection was made. 40 years in a desert. How'd you go?
What was the verse that she was in Ethiopia?
Numbers 12 and verse 1.
Thank you.
Yep. and Ethiopia. 40 years in the desert had a profound effect upon Moses. Profound effect. I'd like you to come to Psalm 90. Because Psalm 90 gives us a little bit of the background of what Moses was thinking during those 40 years. Now, Psalm 90 is a psalm of Moses. How do we know that? Well, just before verse 1 is what's called a superscription. And that superscription is part of the Hebrew text. And that superscription says, a prayer of Moses, the man of God. So we know that Psalm 90 was written by Moses. The question is, when was it written by Moses? Now, one school of thought says it was written during the wilderness journeys. And it was the expression of a man who saw that time was passing before him. I don't believe that's the case, for two reasons. The first is this one, in verse 9 and 10. For all our days are passed away in thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 70 years and 10. And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength, labor, sorrow. For it is soon cut off and we fly away. That would be inappropriate for a man who in the wilderness was approaching 120, where his natural force was unabated. But it would be applicable if he was between 70 and 80 years of age and feeling the pressures of life. Point number one. Point number two, in verse 16, he prays, let thy work appear unto thy servants and thy glory unto their children. In the wilderness, they had seen the glory. That request, it would have been inappropriate, but it would have been highly appropriate if Moses had not yet seen the glory of God. So I believe that Psalm 90 is in fact a psalm written during that 40-year period between meeting Jethro and Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1, when the burning bush was seen. And it really is a psalm which displays a man who is desperate, desperate for some kind of intervention by God.
Is it both 90 and 91?
91 has no superscription, and Psalm 91 is thought to have been written either by Joshua or about Joshua. But that's another story on that one. But Psalm 90 definitely is the Psalm of Moses. Yes, because he's talking about being between 70 and 80, so it's at the end of this 40 years. So he's been with Jethro, his education has continued. 10 years pass, God doesn't appear. 20 years pass, God doesn't appear. 30 years pass, God doesn't appear. 35 years passed, and that's this mood of the psalm.
I guess we'll probably get into it, but my question is, why is he so hesitant then when God does appear?
Right, okay, we will come to that. Okay, we will come to that. Excellent question. See, verse 3, thou turnest men to destruction and sayest, return ye children of men. For 1,000 years in thy sight are as yesterday, when it's passed as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood. They are as asleep in the morning. They're like a grass which groweth up. Now, here's a man who's seeing people come and go, people come and go, generations come and go. Verse 7, we are consumed by thine anger. And he thought that waiting in the desert was an expression of God's anger. Now, the key word in that verse is the word consumed. We are consumed by thine anger. It's a man in verse 16 who's crying, let thy glory appear. Year after year after year in the desert, and there's still no manifestation of the glory of God. So when we come to Exodus chapter 3, the glory of God appears. And look what the record says. Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses in verse 1 kept the flock of Jethro his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came from the mountain of God even to Horeb. And the angel of Yahweh appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, but the bush was not consumed. So here he is in the desert saying that we are consumed by thine anger. Show us thy glory. We're consumed by thine anger. And when God actually appears to Moses, it's in his glory, and he makes the point that it's not consumed. Moses, it's not a question of my anger. It's not a question of my anger. When you said that we are consumed by my wrath, that is not the case at all. So God chose the burning bush as the symbol of his acceptance of Moses, and that the nation of Israel, although they would be afflicted in the furnace of affliction, would not be consumed. Now we're going to leave it there, because our next class in Moses is going to take us through Exodus 3 and 4. We're going to answer the question given about Moses' hesitancy. We're going to see that leadership, in fact, means overcoming your natural tendencies. And we're going to see Moses move across into the greatness of the Exodus itself. An amazing man. A man who was educated for 40 years in a desert. But now the time had come for him to be a prince and a judge over Israel.